What is up? This is Fools. This is the QTR Podcast. Today is August 21st, 2018. It's a beautiful Tuesday in the neighborhood. Real quick, before we get started, a little bit of housekeeping. Just want to let you know the podcast is brought to you ad-free by my Patreons. And if you don't know what Patreon is, it is a recurring donation service that you can use to support with as little or as much as you would like the QTR Podcast. I just want to give a special shout out to some of my most recent Patreons, which are guys like Nathan Master, John Fadul, Steve King, Trevor Courtney, Mike Hanlon, Kevin Boyette, and the guys that are helping out a lot, like Ken R. and also Chris Boas, are coming through in a huge way. Guys like Nev Smith also, Jorge Perlas, and some of my older Patreons like Michael Samuels and Aiden Archer. I appreciate you guys very much. And if I forgot you, I'll get you on the next one because I want to get right to it. Second thing is, there is obviously a two-drink minimum for this podcast. If you don't know that by now, I don't know what the hell you've been doing. But as well, I just want to go on record and say I'm not an investment advisor. This is not investment advice. My guest, Ross, I think actually is an RIA or holds some licenses or something.
Yes,
he could tell me about that. But I'm not. So I guess the moral of the story is don't listen to anything I have to say and do your research elsewhere. You know what? The regulators would tell you you're allowed to listen to Ross. You're not allowed to listen to me. So already that's working in your favor, Ross. Okay. So I have Ross Gerber, who has taken time out of his international like media tour that he's been on over the last 3 weeks talking about Tesla. He's been on television, I think, 12 hours out of the day every day for the last month. He's the co-founder, president, and CEO of Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management. He's been on the podcast before. He's been featured on CNN, CNBC. Jesus, he's got a team that oversees $800 million in investments, and his firm's grown to over 25 employees, and things are going very well for Ross. So without any further ado, what is up?
Hey, how are you, Chris?
I am doing fantastic. I got a million things written down here that I want to ask you.
I figure you got a whole thing ready for me today.
Well, we've exchanged pleasantries off the podcast. So if it's okay with you, I'm going to dive right in.
Yeah, let's dive in. Let's get to it. We only have so much time in a day, and I'm sure your listeners want to get into the meat as soon as possible.
So let's start with the news that broke today, which is Business Insider reported that only 14% of the Model 3s that rolled off the line in the last week of June, the week where Tesla ostensibly used that data to proclaim that they were producing 5,000 a week, that only 14% of those cars didn't need to be reworked. 86% of them actually needed to be reworked.
Right.
What does that tell you about the company's operational efficiency? And for those that are not in the know, we're jumping right into our discussion about Tesla.
Well, there's two things about that. One, you know, I question anything that Business Insider puts out. I don't know if I consider them a legitimate news agency, but, you know, it is what it is. Secondly,
well, Business Insider said that they had cited internal company documents. So,
right, and that's
first
my
problem. I think Lynette Lopez does very good work at Business Insider, but say we disagree on that. If they're citing internal company documents.
Well, I think the bigger issue
documents.
I have is, you know, I read an article, I think, from Charlie at the Wall Street Journal, who I also love and, you know, debate with. And, you know, and I said, you know, what are the names of these suppliers that you claim aren't getting paid? You know, like everybody says, oh, this anonymous, this and that.
Well, you know, why don't so you that, start that, with the 16 mechanic liens that have been filed against the company? I mean,
but let's just assume it's true, you know, what she's claiming.
Well, do you think it isn't?
I just wanted to put a caveat that I don't necessarily buy what I read in Business Insider in particular, but let's just assume what she's saying is true. And it wouldn't surprise me at all, because they had the same problems with the Model S and the Model X when they launched as well. And they had different problems, you know, because we've been involved with Tesla for 5 years. They had different problems on both launches. With the Model S, they had problems with the roofs. And so they were taking every Model S off the production line and then re-putting the roof on in an aftermarket facility when they first launched the Model S. It was not a pretty, you know, thing the first couple months, you know. And then with the Model X, they had all the problems with the doors because they had to make these doors that are incredible, but just ridiculously difficult. So, you know, and Elon said, you know, why did I do this to myself? You know, I think he says this a lot. And but eventually they got that right too. And I think that's with the Model 3. It wouldn't surprise me that you're ramping from 2,000 to 5,000 cars, and then you're pulling these cars off and having to make changes and fixes. Because one of the things Tesla's trying to do is make sure the customer isn't figuring out those problems and dealing with the problems before. But with every new product, any technology product, you're going to have a pretty high, you know, issue rate right off the production ramp. And the idea is obviously to improve those numbers dramatically over the couple months, you know, after, so that you can make better margins on the car.
So, okay, so you've said you don't...
So it doesn't, it wouldn't surprise me if that's the case, and I would think that would be fairly normal for such a complex product. And what they do is they just fix them as, and like, you know, we've seen a few Model 3s, like one in particular that we have that it had a problem with the air conditioning system when we just got it. And, you know, they were super helpful in fixing it and dealt with it and fixed it. And so, you know, that's just part of, I think, the process with Tesla in launching and ramping, that there's just a certain error rate. But the way they've handled these things have been, I think, pretty good with the customers. And, you know, mostly they try to fix these things before the customer actually gets their hands on the car.
But when the company put out their latest shareholder letter, so first let me just ask you this. I mean, are you questioning whether or not Lynette Lopez is reporting something accurate or not at this point? I mean, can we just concede that she's, you know, what she's reporting is based on internal documents? I mean, you don't think she's making that up,
listen,
do you?
Listen, I don't want to get into a debate about Lynette Lopez because it's a total waste of time.
No, I don't think it's a waste of time. I want to know if you
it
think
is. She's a very small-time reporter at a website run by a guy who was disgraced from the investment business because he was a fraud.
Well, the website's, you know, worth hundreds of millions of dollars. It was recently sold.
Right. Lynette was a wonderful site.
Lynette was an adjunct professor at Columbia University. She has a journalism degree from Columbia University. So what I'm asking is, are you saying that her claim that she has reviewed internal company documents, and that the first week that they claimed this production rate, that they were saying 86% of the cars were reworked, is it your stance that that is false, that she's lying?
No, it's what I'm trying to say is that how would Lynette Lopez have confidential documents? Wouldn't that be illegal?
Well, how does anybody get confidential documents? How do reporters get any confidential?
They steal them. Journalists aren't supposed to steal things.
You have no idea, no clue. Ex-employees can, you know, bring stuff to reporters. There's a million different
ways.
It's
not legal. My employees sign a form that says if they release one piece of information, I bury them.
Look, let's...
Okay. We all sign confidentiality agreements and non-disclosure agreements and all these kind of things.
Every reporter who had a source that was an ex-employee or had this type of confidential information, there would be no journalism, because this is where a lot of sources come from in the journalism world. So let's assume that
but I don't want to debate Lynette per se.
I just want to say
her information is accurate, it wouldn't surprise me per se. And that's what I'm trying to say. There's no reason to debate it. I'm sure that they're fixing a lot of cars that are coming off the line, whether it's a little piece of tape's in the wrong place or maybe the bumper falls off. But, you know, they are in a massive ramp-up stage right now. And to try to imagine the difference between making 2,000 cars a week and 5,000 cars a week is just, like, a crazy amount of effort to do. So I think that
I'll concede that to you.
Error rate, and a very high error rate in the first month of that ramp. I think the real question is, once Lynette steals some more documents,
you're making unfounded allegations that she stole these documents.
You told me that she has confidential documents from Tesla.
I did not. It was reported in Business Insider that she found
How would they get this? Somebody's breaking the law.
I don't know, and I can't speculate on that. But you're saying she's stealing documents, which is very different.
Well, it's just like this guy is claiming all these batteries with holes in them. I mean, shouldn't we be seeing Model 3 fires every fucking day? I mean, no. We haven't seen one. Not one out of 40,000 cars have caught on fire yet.
So he's an Exodus.
I'm sure the first Model 3 that catches on fire will be big news, you know, when it happens.
He's an ex-employee.
This guy's claiming there's holes in all the battery systems.
Well, he's claiming that there's, yeah, exactly, that there's punctures in certain VIN numbers that have been that have gone out. Right?
And he posted those VIN numbers, and nobody's seen any issues with these cars. So
yeah, but does that mean that what he's saying isn't true?
We don't know, but my point being is that actual evidence of performance of the vehicle, not one has caught on fire, and there are 40,000 on the road today that have punctured batteries, according to these people.
So what I'm asking
we'll see what the experience is. To be honest, you know, if Model 3 start exploding left and right, we'll see. You know, I mean, there's no hiding.
But don't you think that's a problem that they should nip in the bud to begin with? If an ex-employee is coming out who's somebody that works in operations and works in logistics and says that 40,000 of these vehicles are out there and they've had, you know, essentially battery refurbishments or whatever,
big of a company you've ever run. You know, at one point I ran a pretty big company. I had like 250 employees at my old company, and it just takes one person to make up all kinds of crap. I used to deal with this stuff myself.
Well, I don't,
you know, people leave the company and they would make up stuff and try to defame me, or they got fired for lack of performance or something and they're bitter. I mean, it just takes one person. I could tell you stories if you want on this podcast, which we're not going to do, of all the rogue employees I dealt with and issues I would have to deal with in my old company. And that's one of the reasons I have a lot less employees in my new company, because the more people you have, it only takes one or two or three of these people to create a lot of problems for you, whether they're, you know, legitimate or not, you know?
Well, listen,
we're not going to discuss this. Let's talk about Tesla, because I think
the exciting thing
so, is what's happening with Tesla.
This pertains to it.
Hang on. The ramp is being successful.
Hang on.
You know?
1 second, counselor. I'm directing the proceedings here, okay? Hang on 1 second. So here's what I'll say. I don't need to have run a company with 250 employees to understand what you're saying. I get completely what you're saying, that ex-employees can turn around and cause problems for companies. I just know that from analyzing businesses, and I know that just from common sense. But the only real way that an ex-employee can turn around and create a legitimate problem is if what they're saying holds water. So if Martin Tripp is being truthful in what he's saying, and he believes there's genuinely a safety concern, and he brought it to the attention of his superiors, and Tesla, I guess, according to him, let these cars go anyways, I guess is what he's alleging, right? Now, if that turns out to be true, that's a problem because it's true. If it's not a problem, if it's not true, he's going to be the one that winds up with huge liability and huge issues. So he is facing a $60 billion company that to him probably seems like it has unlimited resources, unlimited capital, even though we know that's not true. But the point is, it's a very disadvantageous position for anybody who's in that position. You could argue they have nothing to lose, but they can be sued for liable. There can be, you know, there can be injunctions. There can be, you know, the company has the leverage, in other words. So,
go ahead. I mean, yes and no. I mean, once again, the motivation between what drives people's, you know, behavior or so on and so forth can be many different factors. And we're not going to speculate what factors this guy has and what issues he may have, nor do I think that everything Elon does or Tesla does is perfect. You know,
right.
I'm not trying to argue that, oh, this is a perfect company. I mean, if you go to the, you know, the factory where they're making iPhones and you look at all the little Chinese kids with bloody fingers, I mean, it's not a pretty sight for Apple either. You know what I mean?
No, that's very true.
And you could say that about almost any company, you know.
That's very true.
So there's always a sort of ugly side to, you know, in the entertainment business, it was the Me Too stuff and hooking up and all this kind of abuse. You know, so there's always ugly sides to businesses. And Tesla is clearly being run by a guy who's got too many, you know, things going on, obviously, and way too much stress. So to tell me certain things, you know, are not how they should be, wouldn't surprise me. Oh, there's scraps in this place, or some guy hit his head on a machine, or, you know, that's part of the bad side of the way Tesla does things. And nor do I think I would say, oh, this is the ideal way to do a product launch and ramp. You know, I mean,
Well, I think what the investing public takes exception to is these optimistic targets that he's come out and set, saying they're going to be making $20,000 a month at the end of the year last year, and then not being able to live up to that. And it's not something that's happened once. It's happened over and over. I think
just recently he started tempering the way he was saying stuff on the last call because he constantly does this. And as investors, like, we just never took it at face value. Now, you know, so when Elon says, oh, the car is going to come out in this day, we add 6 months to a year. You know what I'm saying? So we don't model based off what Elon says. We model based off what we think is going to happen. Now, if other investors don't factor that in, I can see where their frustration lies. But there's a strategy behind Elon's, you know, proclamations, because it's a way of pushing himself to achieve things. And
you can't do that as a public company. You're not allowed to do that as a public company. You're not allowed to guess at what it is that you're going to, you know, you're not allowed to set expectations for yourself personally.
Well, companies miss expectations every report. Every report, a company misses expectations.
What you're saying is that he's setting these expectations in order to motivate himself to push to reach these goals, when what he should be doing is he should be thinking conservatively about what's realistically possible and delivering that to the market.
I think the biggest flaw in Tesla exists that we all have seen now in full view, which is a lack of just that solid button-down COO that Elon respects and can say, hey, you know what? I get where you're going with it. That's an internal target, but externally, we're going to model this. And I don't think Tesla could do any smarter move right now than find somebody that Elon respects that has a phenomenal operating background that can step in and start systematizing these things instead of listening to the sort of ramblings of the brilliant founder. You know what I mean?
Well, that's
so this
I agree,
is a big maturity
I agree with
moment
there.
For Tesla.
I agree with you there. And it's been my experience personally and from also, you know, watching businesses unfold as an analyst, that sometimes that can be a very weird dynamic when a founder needs to relinquish some of the operational part of the job to somebody else. It can be very beneficial. So I agree with what you're saying, that it's important, but it can be very sticky. Just as I think the relationship between the board and I think Elon is probably getting a little sticky as well. I just want to go back real quick.
Well, it's probably pretty sticky everywhere around there right now, right?
Well, I would imagine it seems like everybody is fending for themselves a little bit when it comes to the. We'll talk about the board in a second.
Not what I think is happening, but
Well, here, I just want to go back.
I have a wonderful CEO, my partner, Danilo Kawasaki. You know, we started the business understanding what our strengths and weaknesses were. And we built around that from the beginning. And I think that's where Tesla's weakness is that, you know, he really needs a partner within Tesla, like he kind of has with SpaceX with his operating officer there.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you that somebody with know-how, you know, like if they had recruited... If they had
like
recruited...
Somebody who's going to sit down.
If they had recruited Sheryl Sandberg... Like they said I like Sheryl Sandberg. So
she's an excellent operator with no morals or values at all, and I don't think that works with Elon.
I would have rethought some things if they had brought Sheryl Sandberg in, because
everybody likes Sheryl Sandberg who doesn't know her. You know what I mean?
I don't need to know her. All I need to know is what the companies have done that she's worked for. And her.
That's true. She has an excellent track record. Period. But she's made $1 billion at Facebook, and I don't think she's going anywhere.
I would agree. I don't think Tim Cook is going to be leaving Apple anytime soon to go to Tesla.
What'd you say?
I said I agree. Just as I believe Tim Cook is not going to be leaving Apple anytime soon to go to Tesla.
No, and you know, I wasn't suggesting that Tim Cook leave Apple. I think it's more that he would be the ideal type of person for an Elon Musk. I mean, it's like literally a perfect match of personalities, of the guy who won't take a risk, who's solid as a rock, and the crazy guy who's taking risks, and together they could make beautiful music together, I think.
Well, I watched I watched your Bloomberg interview this morning, and it sounded like you were suggesting that Tim Cook. I watched the replay.
Well, yeah,
it sounded like you were suggesting
Tim
Cook.
What my ideal would be, and I was like, oh well, Tim Cook, and I was laughing. Because it was like, you know, I was saying this is a dream. That's actually what I was quoted, that I had this dream, you know,
that would
be my dream. And you know, I own a lot more Apple than Tesla, so I couldn't imagine what would happen to Apple.
And that's an investment I will never give you shit on, man. I've been an Apple bull for many, many years. So
yeah, since I was a kid. That's been an easy one, though.
These
Teslas are a lot more challenging.
Let me just circle the square on the first thing that we talked about, which was these Model 3s rolling off the line at a rate of, you know, only 14% of them are good to go. The article came out and said that the amount of hours that they were working on them subsequent to that report, I guess, that Lynette had somehow ascertained, that there was a 30% reduction in the amount of labor hours that were going into Model 3s. So I did some very back-of-the-envelope calculations, and it seems as though if the industry standard for vehicles rolling off the line ready to go is 65% to 80%, which is what the expert in the article claimed, and let's just say, we'll say 70% just to go a little bit lower than the midway.
But isn't that off a production line that's already existing, not like starting from scratch, that statistic?
Well, Fremont was up and running prior, right? I mean, what are you saying? Your point is that because they
made this many cars. So, like, you know, if I'm running like the Toyota factory making Priuses, I've been doing that for some time. Like, I got a 60-80% success rate.
So let's use the new figure then. We'll use the updated figure of a 30% reduction, which is what I guess what the most recent comment was.
Right.
It's still, to my calculation, is that the company is spending 30 days worth of work more on per 5,000 vehicles than an automobile manufacturer that rolls these off the line at a 70% completion rate. So what my question is to you is, after years and years of hearing that they're going to have this fantastic factory that's the alien dreadnought, and it's going to be autonomy like we've never seen before, and it's going to rewrite the industry and what's capable in automobile manufacturing, to all of a sudden, all right, well, we had to rip some of the automated shit out and replace it with some manual parts. And okay, we've got to fly some shit in from Germany now. And then, all right, well, we don't really have the capacity, so we're going to put up GA4. We're going to put up the tent. To get from there, where we were going to rewrite the industry, and that's what a lot of people heard while the stock was on its way up and while capital raises were taking place, to what's being reported today, seems like a very drastic difference, doesn't it?
Well, yes, like you're saying, to the ideal, Tesla is far from that. And
okay, good, stop there. I'm just playing.
No, but I mean, I get what you're saying, and, you know, I'm not going to disagree. I think that they're making cars out of a tent that's never been done before, and when he was asked, so that was one of my questions, like, is this tent permanent, you know, like, what are you going to build a wall around the tent and then eventually take the tent down? Like, you know, and so what he ended up saying was, this is actually more efficient because they can put, you know, places in the production where they need parts, they can move them easier, blah, blah, blah. And they've seemed to have improvised this into a better idea, supposedly. And, you know, I was offered the opportunity to go look at all this stuff. And, you know, I haven't taken them up, but the ISI, I think it was IHI guys went, I don't know, 2 weeks ago, and they came back from the factory very, very impressed. And so, you know, I'll take their word for it after three tours and 48 hours that things are getting better and things are getting cleaned up and smoother. And I actually very much expect a certain level of problems. And I like to compare it to when the iPhone came out, and most people forget that you couldn't get an iPhone. It was incredibly difficult to get one. Once you got an iPhone, they work like crap. I mean, the phone didn't really work. You could only sign up with AT&T, and
that's not
my
true.
Calls
the,
would drop.
The phone did not work like crap.
It did. It was a piece of crap.
I
have one right here on my desk.
Well, of course, now it's 10 years old.
I would make call after call. It would drop. I had two phones for a while because I couldn't make phone calls on the iPhone that would actually last. So I had to keep like my Nokia or BlackBerry, whatever the hell I had,
so,
to make phone calls, and then I would use the iPhone for the other things.
So I hold on 1 second. I worked at Apple when the original iPhone was released. I worked for Apple for a short amount of time after I left college, and I was working for the company when they released the iPhone. So I literally was there for the first iPhone launch. I got to hold one of the first models as it came into the store.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, so I'm telling you, my experience with the iPhone is very different. That it didn't, you know, it didn't drop a lot of calls for me. I thought it was
tainted by your love for Apple, you know, which you don't have for Tesla. So it's like
No. There's no tainting. There's either the calls were dropping all the time or they weren't. I mean, it's an objective.
They were.
Doesn't have anything to do with whether
or
not.
Well documented that the antennas had issues. Remember, you had to like if you put your thumb over a certain part of the antenna, it would just drop the call and. They had to like wrap the antennas differently, and then, you know, they did several different versions of the antennas before they got it right.
I do remember
links to the article.
No. You don't have to. I do remember that there was antenna problems, but I didn't have, and I know exactly what you're talking about. The way the antenna wrapped around the outside of the phone, I remember going through the whole thing.
Anyways, but the moral being is, it wasn't a perfect product, but it was revolutionary. And over the many iterations over the years, it got better and better.
Iterations.
Production got better and better, and they were able to fill. Thank you.
You're welcome.
They were able to fill orders quicker and quicker. And, you know, you used to wait 7 months to get your phone, five, seven, six, 7 months to get a phone. I mean, now you get them in a few weeks or right away. You know, production has gotten so much better at Apple, and quality has gotten better, and performance, everything.
So,
and I expect we'll see the same thing with Tesla over the next couple of years.
Well, what do you think about the fact that people that want a Model 3 are now able to get them much quicker? Do you think that's indicative of demand drying up, or do you think that's indicative of supply being ramped up? I mean, what do you think in a case like...
I think it's indicative of Tesla marketing. You know, I know four or five people who are waiting for cars right now. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, they're saying like 4 months. So when they first updated the website, I called them and I go, You're crapping me that I can get a car in 4 months. You know, I don't believe you. Or it was like 3 months originally, and then like the next day they updated the website and made it longer. You know, I think that I know four people.
Wait,
that
you,
I'm watching.
You called them and they updated the website the next day?
Well, I emailed them when I saw they had originally changed delivery times to like two to three months or something. It was like really short. And so I sent them an email that day. I go, how is this possible? I know people who are in line to wait till September, and you're telling me I can order a car now and get it before them. People are going to be pissed off. Like, how does that work? You know, and then they were like, oh, our mistake or whatever. This is how we're doing it. And then, like, the next day the website was updated with a little bit longer time. And I think that those are estimates. And so Tesla has a backlog. I think September is going to be a huge month for Tesla because I know a lot of people are supposed to get it. And that's part of the reason they're working so hard to get these cars out, is that there is still a huge backlog of people who are getting more and more impatient because you see them on the roads now here. So, you know, it's like I've got a guy in my office waiting for one, and he's just like, it's killing him because we've already gotten two here in the office. And, you know, we're probably getting another two in the next couple months. And, you know, they're dying for this stuff. So Tesla's got to get these cars in people's hands because obviously the customers are just getting antsy. It's been 2 years, you know. So we expect a lot of deliveries.
What about the customers that have, you know, that were promised a $35,000 model? Do you think they're getting antsy?
Well, I think nobody was promised anything. People.
Wait a second. He sold the Model 3 that it was going to be a $35,000 vehicle.
And it will be a $35,000 car.
Nobody was promised anything. That was the whole basis of the Model 3's appeal.
He didn't say that the $35,000 car people would get their car first.
Well,
he said, we're going to make this car for $35,000.
You're right about that. But, I mean, here we are
and now
over 2 years later, and we don't have the
$35,000.
Yeah, I know. That's so fucking ridiculous that he even said that. What do you think about
it? A little premature, again.
Don't you think that's insane for him
to
come out and say that?
3 years.
I don't care if he said 3 years, 30 years, or 3 months. The fact that he's even talking about a $25,000 vehicle when he has not delivered the $35,000 vehicle is ridiculous. It goes to show you.
But the conversation was in the context of of talking about scale and economies of scale now that the car is ramping up.
What do you say to somebody that put a deposit down, okay, which is on Tesla's balance sheet for a $35,000 Model 3, and they're just kind of sitting out in limbo, and they're watching, like you said, your employees, they're watching other Model 3s drive down the street, and they're just sitting there holding their dongs waiting for their car.
Right, and so there's two ways to approach that. One, they can easily just get back their $1,000 and just wait until there is a $35,000 model of any car that's anything like this, and they can buy whatever car that comes out that's like it, that's electric. Nobody's saying they shouldn't. Or two, they just wait, but it's the same thing that happens when you get on a plane. When you get on a plane, they don't say, well, all the people who bought coach get on first. They don't do that. Okay, why? Because I just paid a lot of money for my business class seat, and I'm getting on before you. And if you don't like it, that's life, you know? I mean, it's just the way things are. And so if I buy a concert ticket for $200, it's better than a concert ticket for $100, and I'm going to sit in the front, and you're going to sit in the back.
Yeah, but the concert wasn't sold.
So the back goes last.
The concert wasn't sold to the public that everybody's going to be able to pay, you know, the general admission price to get in.
I didn't buy that car thinking I was going to pay $35,000. I bought the car thinking I was going to pay $55,000.
Well, what do you think about... Okay, so do you take exception to the fact that during the Model 3 reveal, the $35,000 price target was pushed out there and then capital was raised subsequent to that and he still hasn't delivered that vehicle? Does that bother you at all?
It would bother me if he never delivers the vehicle. But right now, I'm just happy that he's delivered any vehicles. Like, don't you think you're being a little bit premature? I mean, they've made 40,000 of these cars total. They got, you know, 30,000 more this quarter. They're at 72,000.
I'm not being premature. I'm trying to hold him accountable
to
what he's saying.
It's just a little bit of time. Relax. You know, relax. We'll get you a $35,000 car.
I'm cool as a cucumber. I've never been more relaxed in my life.
No, I know, but I'm just saying to the customer, you say, look, if you want the cheapest version of the car, you know, then you got to relax.
But it's been 2 years.
I know. It's been 2 years.
So how long do you expect people to relax? People are going to start dying soon.
Well, they can go back to driving their Priuses, you know? I mean, once again, nothing is stopping them from getting back in their Prius or Bolt and driving around in that thing until the car comes, you know? You know, it is what it is. First of all, the car is so good. The fact that they could even make this car and sell it for $35,000 is insane, because it's definitely on a higher level than most Mercedes's and Beamers and stuff. So if he can make this car in mass and sell it for $35,000 and make money, that's going to be
amazing. Well, he can't. He himself said he can't make money selling the car at $35,000, right?
Not today, right. Not today.
Right, so that takes care of that. All right, let's move.
So let's just assume the car's a $55,000 car for now. And, you know, it is what it is. What they're really trying to sell is the performance versions and the dual motors, which is what a lot of people I know are waiting for.
This is like...
Which are even more expensive versions of the car, you know?
This is like where I grew up in New Jersey. There was an electronics store down the street from my house called Sixth Avenue Electronics, which was like one of these sleazy, you know, New York City-based electronics stores that was always trying to fuck you. And the deal with them was the old bait and switch. So they would advertise in like the Sunday news for, you know, a camcorder for $299.
Right,
and you would go into the store and they would be quote unquote out of stock, but they got a 349, a 399 model, whatever, that they wanted to sell you. And at one point, you know, my mother wound up going in there for something. I forget what it was, a long time ago. And they did the same thing to her. You know, they said, all right, well, we know the ad says $300, but we have a $399 model or whatever. And then all of a sudden, there was this big class action lawsuit, and then people wanted to participate, and it was getting all this negative press. And it was, you know, the case had some legitimacy because it was a bait and switch. You don't think this is a bait and switch to go out and sell the public a $35,000 car?
What I want you to do is open up your paper right now, and they have these, like, sections with the car ads.
Yeah,
and if you open up the section to, let's say, the Toyotas or the Mercedes, you'll see every single ad there says, get this model, $2,000 down, and $300 a month. And in the fine print, it says, we have one at this price point.
Well, there was no fine print in the $35,000 in the Model S
company in America advertises this way, every day in every paper.
There was no fine print in the Model 3 reveal. He stood on stage with the number 35,000 behind him.
He's eventually going to make the car. He didn't stay on stage and say, this is going to be the first version we make. He said, I'm going to eventually get you this car, and it might be in 2090. But he's going to do it, you know. I think
is
it's
that
much
actually
more
a
bait
defense?
And switch.
Does that defense actually make sense to you? It could be in 2090? Come on.
Well, that was a joke. But
all right.
But the point being is, if I put an ad in the paper offering a specific car to people thinking that, oh, I can buy this car for $250 a month, and I get there, and there's one model that way that was sold, you know, 27 years ago. Listen, if you want to go into business ethics questions about car dealerships, I think you're going to lose this argument, because car dealerships are the fucking worst, man. They're the worst.
I don't doubt that.
So
your argument is because it's a sleazy industry. Your argument is because it's a sleazy industry that this is okay? Is that your argument?
No, I'm just saying they're so bad. So, you know, I'm not trying to say that if I thought I was going to get a $35,000 car and it's going to take me next year, that that's not disappointing. It's disappointing, okay? But it's also technology.
Okay.
But if you put an ad in and say, oh, I've got a $35,000 car, you can go buy it right now, and I show up at the lot and that doesn't exist, well, that's what every car company is doing right now.
So how long do you think is a reasonable amount of time for them to deliver the $35,000 model, in your opinion? I would just want to get you on
record. I'd like to see them do that next year. I mean, I think in a year they'll be able to do this. I think that they've got – now, I'm looking at Bloomberg right now. They're up to 6,000 cars a week right now. And if they can focus on quality and improve the Lynette Lopez statistics, this is really important to increasing margins. I think that they'll be able to deliver that car next year. You know, probably, I'm hoping, by June. But they're making improvements now faster than I've expected, and that they're letting on. So I think they finally figured out to under-promise and over-deliver after all these years of sort of the opposite. Because, you know, they're at 6,000 cars right now. Like, they'll do 6,000 this week.
Okay. All right. So I guess let's dovetail from that into what you think about this whole going private disaster. Now, do you want me to ask you? Do you want me to ask you a question first, or do you want to state your case first? I'll give you the option.
Well, I mean, you know, I've gone through a lot of sort of thought about this with different people in my firm, because, you know, the people here aren't necessarily here to just, you know, say whatever. They're here to have their opinions too, and I think you know, there's two ways to look at the going private. So first, the day that it happened was really weird, because, you know, it was just announced in the morning that the Saudis had bought 5% of Tesla, and it was only about, I think, about an hour afterwards when they tweeted that.
Yep.
So it was like a really awkward thing, because typically you wouldn't do that, because you already made the announcement of the 5%. The stock was already moving higher. You know, there was no need for him to do that. So, you know, we could all analyze why he did it on the supposedly way to the airport after breaking up with Grimes or whatever the fuck was going on.
Oh, wait, he broke up with Grimes then?
I don't know. I don't know. I hope he has.
All right, well, let's talk about this. If he doesn't have a term sheet and committed funding, is that securities fraud in your opinion?
No, and this is where I think it gets interesting. So,
me too.
Right now, I think we don't know what he has or didn't have or whatever. It was clearly premature. We know that, but we don't know what's actually happening. And in fact, everybody at the company's been incredibly quiet. I don't know anything. What I've seen recently is clear that Goldman and Morgan are jumping on the fee bandwagon.
Yeah, well, that's
here.
Now. That's very different.
No,
than...
that's now. But see, what I think his argument that he's trying to make that will ultimately protect him from being, you know, accused of fraud or whatever, is that he disclosed early, and early disclosure is actually appreciated by the SEC. So it's really an issue of whether this is true or not. And this
Ross,
is what we
they're
were,
saying he rounded up from 419 to 420 just because he liked the number better.
Yeah, I thought
better.
That was smart.
That's a several hundred million dollar difference in the valuation of the company. How is that smart?
It's smart if it's your stock.
Come on.
No, I think that
let me just explain something real quick, okay? If you're the CEO of a public company, you can't come out and say funding is secured for a bid at $420 a share because somebody fucking wrote to you on a cocktail napkin that maybe, you know, or your calculations internally
that's not what he claims.
Hold on 1 second.
He didn't.
You can't do it. You just can't do it. It's fraud.
Right, but that's not what he claims.
He claimed he had funding secured, and he did not have funding secured.
On July 31st with the Saudi Investment Fund, and that they agreed to do this deal. That's what he's claiming.
So he's claiming what, a verbal agreement?
Yeah.
Well, that's not going to cut it. That's not going to cut it with the SEC.
And that's why I think now the only way he can get himself out of this is by getting a deal done. And so that's what I think he's working on.
Well, I don't think whether or not he closes a deal now will protect him from what he did. I mean, the point is you can't come out and make such a disclosure if you don't have a deal in place. It's that simple.
I think it will totally protect him if he gets the deal done.
No, that's disclosed early.
It's going to be hard to say anybody was damaged.
That's like me coming out and lying and saying I definitively know that Apple's going to be bought out for $250 a share tomorrow when I have no fucking idea whether or not they are. Just as I'm being accused of fraud or you know, wrongdoing for that, the company incidentally makes a deal for that. You know,
I don't think that's incidental. I think he's been working on this deal.
Do you think he has a good understanding of how the capital markets work?
Of course.
And how disclosure works? What do you mean, of course
he does.
What do you mean, of course?
He's raised money over and over and over again.
Anybody that has an of course understanding of how disclosure works doesn't do what he did.
No, what he did was stupid. I don't think that's the debate. I'm not going to defend that this was a great idea for him. What I'm trying to say is it doesn't mean that he committed fraud. It means that he might have been stupid. There's a difference between making a stupid mistake and lying. Okay, so I'll give you an example, and this was the debate we were having last night with several members of our team, is this even real or not? And what the market is saying, like with the stock, is that they don't believe this is even real.
Well, does it concern you that the board of directors hadn't heard anything about it?
No, it doesn't, because I think the board of directors is like a group of people who are doing their own thing, and if there isn't a meeting,
what
for
is
some
that?
Reason to be communicated.
What is doing your own thing? They're not supposed to be doing their own thing.
Dude,
they're
what
supposed
do you think
to
boards
be...
of directors do?
Well, they're supposed like to they govern the executives at a company.
No, but they don't work at the company. They're people that come in once a quarter, or they have their meetings. You know, it's like you're a board member. You're not management.
But you're governing management.
Right. So should he report to the board that he has a deal before
he
tweets it? Probably should, right?
Yes.
But he didn't. But that's not a crime. That's stupid. It's different.
Well, look, I'll concede to you that if there was deliberate deception, it's fraud. And if there was not deliberate deception, you could argue something else. At the very least, it was universally stupid from somebody that you're claiming.
Nobody's going to debate that.
Okay.
I agree 100%. It was stupid. He's tired. He's exhausted. He's dating some weird Canadian chick. And who knows if he was breaking up or not breaking up. And he's getting in this car. And he's like, you know what? I'm tired of this stuff. I'm going private. Done deal. You know, it's stupid. We all make mistakes.
That's very true.
I've done it too. And I tweeted a stupid thing, you know, 4 months ago, and it was a very painful process to fix it. And it got fixed.
What was that? What did you tweet 4 months ago?
I brought up a political issue.
I remember that.
The Trump campaign.
Yeah. Okay.
And, you know, I tried to organize a protest, and it turned into an attack on my company by all these right-wing people and bots and all these things. And, you know, if it only involved me, I wouldn't have been is annoyed with myself, but people were threatening my employees and you know, these people are crazy and I felt horrible. I don't know if I've ever felt as bad as an executive of being responsible for 25 people, but I made such a bad mistake And you know, and I swore to myself, I'm gonna learn. And fortunately, I got out of that mistake because they were computers and bots. It went away after 2 days, but I learned a lesson there. You know, and it's like this Twitter thing. You know, and it's not necessarily the best place to tell all your inner feelings,
Ross,
about how much you hate Trump or something.
Everybody,
you know what I mean?
Everybody has made a mistake like that. So I don't care how many people are giving you shit over it. I don't care what the fuck people tell you. Anybody that tells you they haven't made a mistake like that is lying. I have, Elon Musk has, everybody has. So,
right.
So
I agree.
Let me just tell you.
I think it was a costly mistake, and it really bothers me that he did it, and it's probably the only thing
But how about this?
I don't know.
How about this, brother? Listen to this, all right? He has made a multitude of mistakes on Twitter. One after the other.
Right, okay.
So now let me say this. If the board of directors was doing their job, okay, which is to govern, and they have a fiduciary obligation to shareholders, if any other CEO on the Dow, on the S&P, had come out and called that guy a pedophile on Twitter, any other board, Microsoft, General Motors, Coca-Cola, General Electric, you name it, Apple, whatever, doesn't matter how revolutionary or how old school they are, every single board of directors would have either reprimanded the CEO, you know, created a special committee to investigate it. There would have been, he would have either had to step down or there would have been some type of consequences. And in this case, there were no consequences for that. As a matter of fact, his apology was this half-assed, you know, he was replying to somebody else on Twitter. And that's where he made his apology. He didn't put out a public statement. He didn't say what I did was wrong.
I think you're right.
So hold on. My point here is that if the board of directors was doing their job then, that this second thing here, which if they had come through and said, hey, you just can't do it anymore. You can't tweet anymore. Otherwise, we're going to be after your ass. Right? But Elon's running the company, it looks like, not the board of directors, because he did not stop. He was not publicly reprimanded. He barely publicly apologized. And the next thing you know, 3 weeks later, or a month later, whatever it is, he comes out and makes this other statement now that has him in another pool of hot water, which has created a potentially massive legal liability, not only for the company, but for the board of directors. So what does that tell you about corporate governance at the company? Do they need new board members?
I think this is probably your best point. And nor is it surprising, because so many companies' boards don't really do their jobs. And certainly, if you're going to blame anybody for being completely weak and feckless, is fucking board. I mean, it's unbelievable. They know the guy needs help. I mean, these are all actions that are a byproduct of just unbelievable exhaustion, whatever he's doing to even survive right now under the pressure he's under, which has got to be just horrible, you know?
How do you know it's from exhaustion and not just poor judgment?
Well, I think you would get more poor judgment with exhaustion. And I know because I have a little baby. And when the baby keeps me up and I'm exhausted after working 14 hours, I tend to get really pissed off and do dumb things at an exponentially higher amount. So we all behave that way. That's why sleep deprivation is a form of torture that we used on the ISIS guys and all this stuff. They keep them up all night long. That's how you get them to talk.
How do you reconcile that explanation with, you know, all these media reports of he's using recreational drugs, and then he comes out and he's, you know, crying to the New York Times that he's exhausted when meanwhile there's photographs of him over the last 2 years. He's out, he's partying, he's cracking. He's got plenty of time to crack jokes on Twitter. He's got time to fucking, you know, make sure that David Einhorn gets a pair of short shorts in the mail. So maybe, have you considered that maybe he's not using his time in the best way possible, as opposed to, you know, if he's up for,
well,
if he's up for
I,
18
I
hours and he's doing something productive 2 hours versus why
I,
does
I think
he
your
just
other argument's better. And to say that the board's been negligent in doing certain things that I think they should have done, absolutely. Absolutely. And if there's anybody to blame beyond Elon for his actions, certainly the board could have taken steps to help him, or to I don't know if you can like gag him, but like in the sense of, you know, they're just weak people, to be honest.
Well,
you know,
you
Elon's
can replace him. I mean,
in theory, he owns 20% of the company. You know, you've got index funds that own a lot of the stock. So it's like, you know, it's very hard to do that.
Well, it's
when the owner owns so much of the company.
Well, it's
unless you're like Papa John and you're dumb enough to fire yourself. You know,
it's not. Yeah, but you don't think calling somebody a pedophile is, you know, closely akin to what the Papa John's founder did?
No. I don't think so at all. The Papa John's founder is a racist pig, and it's not even comparable to being angry at some weird guy who might actually be a pedophile.
Why is he weird?
But I don't know. I just saw something.
Why is he weird?
I don't
want to
go into my opinions.
You said he's a weird guy. He was instrumental in rescuing these children from a cave in Thailand. I want to know why he's weird. Why is it weird?
I don't want to go into this diver or not. We're getting off the point. I think your point is valid. I think Elon is suffering. I think that became very clear by his tearful.
I agree with you.
Thing. I think he's suffering from his own making. I don't feel sorry for him. You know what I mean? I think he thought maybe people might feel sorry for him, but that was not the reaction. People just sold the stock and had less confidence in him. And I think he needs help, and I don't think there was a more obvious cry for help. And the fact that the board in general, now maybe going private is now a way for them to force Elon to get the help he needs. You know, maybe this is the moment the board can step up if they do have any, you know, balls and really want to, you know, make the company better. Or maybe they're just a bunch of lay down, you know, board members who collect their check and will do whatever they say. But I think it's too early to tell what's going to happen. And so that's why I think this story is so interesting still, is we actually still don't know a lot of information, you know. And so they're very quiet right now. I think we're going to start seeing some more information in the next week or two, and then we'll be able to tell the extent of the board's control or not control, the bid's veracity or not, Elon's mental health or not.
To know about the veracity of the board's control. The board's in control if they want to be.
No, I mean whether or not they're actually going to exert that control, you know.
Right.
So I do think that I blame boards for most issues in companies. I think most boards are a joke. I think most activists feel that way. And, you know, I consider myself an activist in that I do try to leverage, you know, my outcomes that I think companies should be doing.
Yeah, but the boards of the other companies that you own aren't jokes. Apple's board isn't a joke. Disney's board isn't a joke. Do you think Apple or Disney's board is a joke?
Well, Jack Dorsey's still on Disney's board, but whatever.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Did they get rid of him?
What's wrong with Jack Dorsey?
Oh, God.
All right, different discussion for a different day, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think that, have you seen what's going on at Twitter? You want to see a really broken company, you should...
There's probably some stuff we could agree on there, actually, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah.
I want to stick to things that we don't agree on.
I think Twitter's a good short.
Okay, I disagree, but okay, all right.
Well, you know, we'll see. I don't take those positions, so whatever. I mean, I'm actually just looking at weed business plans all week. I mean, it's
amazing. Do you own any Tilray?
Not Tilray. We own Kronos and we own some Canopy, but not as much as I'd wish. You know.
All right, hang on. I don't want to have mission creep here.
I know, because that's a fun topic too. But anyway,
we're gonna have to do a separate podcast on
a podcast. There's
a podcast.
A podcast.
Yeah, exactly. A podcast. We'll both get stoned, and then we'll talk about pot companies.
So I think that you have valid points, and you've always had valid points. But I think that we can clearly see through this time frame, and I would say it's been, you know, almost a year of just stress and struggling that, you know, Tesla has been going through to do what they claim or what they wanted to do in their business plan. And I think that they're going to get there despite all these pain and issues. And so hopefully Elon hasn't given himself a self-inflicted wound that will damage the company in a very material way.
What is your internal risk management look like on the trade? I mean, what is it that could cause you to go out and dump your stock tomorrow? What have you established internally is going to be, you know, not necessarily your stop from a price standpoint, but if you do have one from a price standpoint, I'd like to hear it. But also, what what would push you over the edge to dump?
Well,
the
I mean, what we were most concerned about, and where sort of we started was where we were, you know, I don't know, a year ago, and you know, I got an email saying I'm not getting my car for 3 or 4 more months, you know, and then it's like, oh, we only made, you know, 1600 in Q4, and you know, I was really concerned of their ability to ramp. I think it's an incredibly challenging thing, especially on the battery technology side, to make that many battery packs. And that I think was where the bottleneck originally started, was in the battery packs. And, you know, so what we're still concerned about is their ability to execute, kind of like, you know, are the cars good? Are they kind of, how many people are happy or sad with their cars? How many times are they going to have to go back to the service center once they get a car? You know, quality levels. You know, so all these things are a really important part of looking at Tesla, because their financial performance is going to be directly related to their actual, you know, production performance. And you know, and this stuff is really starting to happen, and that's why we're excited. You know, I'm looking at 6,000 cars a week right now. I was looking at 2,000 cars a week 6 months ago, and I'm really, really pleased with that. And my own experience with the car now several months in, and I've had no issues, is I love the car, and I think the product is phenomenal, and I think we can get very caught up in all the things. But as somebody like yourself who was a part of the original iPhone launch, I feel this is very, very similar with transportation as what the iPhone did for communication. And so, you know, I get where you're coming from with your concerns and the issues, and I'm not trying to invalidate them, but I think, you know, when you look at the other side of this coin, wow, you know, they could really do, you know, 130,000 cars over the next 6 months, and wow, they could really do $6 billion in revenue this quarter and actually break even. You know, this is an incredible improvement in financial performance for the company and make themselves sustainable. And you've got a company that could be worth a substantial amount in 12 months.
Okay, so I want to – I watched a couple of your interviews. There's been like 6 of them over the last 2 days. I watched the one on Bloomberg this morning, like I was telling you earlier. So right. I had a couple of quotes I pulled from there that I wanted to ask you about, and then a couple of tweets, and then we'll get on with our lives here. So listen, the Saudis reportedly and you know have a term sheet with Lucid Motors. You said on Bloomberg that the Saudis were investing $1 billion into, quote, a total loser startup. Now, right. my question to you is, since Lucid is being head up, at least in part, by the former chief engineer of the Model S, why are they a total loser startup? Why shouldn't they be afforded a chance the way that Tesla should be was afforded a chance at the same stage in its infancy?
Well, I think that, you know, we've seen this. So remember the Fisker Karma that came out? That was a really beautiful car. I mean, you know, gorgeous car. All the hope and promise in the world, and you know, it didn't get anywhere. And you know, I think Elon has proven how difficult it is to build and manufacture a car from scratch, you know. But $1 billion is really not going to get Lucid anywhere. And Lucid is essentially, if you look at the website, is just trying to copy Tesla. So, like, this Lucid website, have you looked at it? It's literally just copying Tesla. And so do I believe that they can actually build these cars in mass and deliver them? No, I don't believe they can.
Well, I'm looking at the website right now. I mean, I don't know that they're trying to the vehicle looks profoundly different than the Model S.
No, not the vehicle itself. I'm just saying look at the website.
All websites look the same. They're all made on Squarespace.
The nice house and the white interiors and the big sky roofs. And the scenes of California.
They probably both hired the same fucking focus group to help them design their website is probably the likely scenario, which...
I mean, their battery pack design.
I want to know
basically
what...
their app is... Look at the app in the picture. It's literally the same as the Tesla app.
What?
They just changed the car.
What makes them a total loser startup, though, I want to know?
Well, because I consider these kind of companies just they're not gonna make it. I mean, they're loser startups.
Couldn't you argue that $1 billion is gonna go a lot further for them than it would for a company like Tesla at its size now? I mean, $1 billion is probably material to them at this stage in their growth, right?
Right, but like $1 billion is gonna get this car to market.
Well, who said that they're trying to get the car to market? Maybe they're trying to make an early stage investment, and then maybe they'll go public and they'll use that money to bring a car to market.
Yeah, well, you know, once again, I wish them luck. I'm all for EV experiences, but I think Saudi Arabia putting $1 billion into this company is just like a long shot bet. I don't look at that as like some sort of legitimate competitor to anybody. They don't even have a car.
Well, they have a term sheet, though.
Yeah, they got a term sheet for $1 billion. So you think if the Saudis will throw $1 billion at this, what's 10 or 20 billion at Tesla, right?
Possibly. You could make that argument. If they're trying to diversify across all EVs, that's a fair argument to make.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think that's their strategy.
Does Tesla have a term sheet with the Saudis?
I don't know.
I don't know either. It hasn't been reported. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. We just may not know about
it. Well, we're going to know soon. That'll be the fun part.
Okay, so you said... So here's the other thing I wanted to ask you about. You said in the Bloomberg report that you like to buy under 300 and that you didn't add, obviously, at 350, 360. And then on Twitter back in the first week of August, if I can find it here, you said, while the stock was at $348, time to put the screws on the shorts, putting our cash to work, enjoy. So were you buying at 348, or do you wait to buy until under 300?
We do both.
Okay. So
like, if I have a new client...
So you don't always wait to buy under 300?
No, if a client comes in today with $500,000, you know, we have to buy the portfolio positions we're going to buy, and so we'll buy Tesla, you know, just to make sure... Like, we'll have 20 or 25 stocks in a portfolio, and we want to have all our clients have those 25 stocks. So sometimes we might try to time that more than others. It depends on the client. You know, Tesla, it goes up and down so much, it's really hard to call.
But you're gonna buy them regardless of price in order to give that person exposure to them?
Well, not regardless of price, but you know, that's why people hire us. They don't hire us to just buy index funds, you know what I mean? So if we don't own these companies, then they go, well, we are investing with you because we wanted to own Tesla, you know?
The other thing I wanted to ask you about was you wrote publicly, you were talking about ETFs on Twitter and how they're such a waste. And then I pull up your 13F and 6 out of 8 of your top positions are ETFs.
No, what I said was that a lot of firms only use ETFs. And what they do is they use broad market ETFs, which... I feel, you know, is a wimpy, non-effective strategy for mediocre results. So if you look at every robo-advisor, or if you look at 95% of investment professionals today, just use total stock market indexes or very broad indexes to develop very mediocre portfolios. So I was writing in the context of that we feel that broad ETF portfolios like you see at the robo-advisors and many of our competitors, it's just a bad way to manage money.
Well, you have ETFs as 6 of your top 8 holdings.
Right, but if you notice what kind of ETFs they are, they're sector ETFs.
Right.
And so when we're building a portfolio of stocks, one of the issues we face as a firm is, I would say, at least half the stocks we own are related to technology. So... the upside to that is we can, you know, add alpha to the accounts, but the downside is we add, you know, beta. So, you know, how do we reduce volatility? So we do that through diversification in the portfolio. And because we're not experts at, let's say, the emerging markets, and I'm not flying out to China to talk to companies and stuff, we'll buy the index. So like the emerging markets index and the developed market index is actually our biggest positions, technically speaking. But that's our exposure to the foreign markets. You know what I'm saying? So we don't. We do own one or two foreign stocks now, not including the pot ones. But in general, besides, you know, let's say we own some Pago Seguros and we own SolarEdge, which is an Israeli company. But in general, We'll stay away from buying the Balzans and the Tencents. We own some of that stuff. We would rather own the index. So when we see an area of the market that is advantageous that we're not experts in, like healthcare, we'll add the biotech index, or we'll add like a medical device index we're adding right now.
Well,
so we look at that as like buying five stocks or seven stocks instead of just one.
Well, what you wrote is owning stocks, because you didn't specify, and that's why there's some confusion here.
You wrote
owning stocks is clearly superior to an all ETF portfolio. ETF robos are basically tricycles, poorly built tricycles. And then you're the six ETFs that you own are finance, technology, and healthcare. So you're spread right across three different sectors there. Right?
And the finances are a hedge against our bond portfolio.
How does that work?
Well, because rates are rising, and we own bonds for most of our clients at some part of their portfolio. So financials tend to, you know, perform better in a rising rate environment. So we offset our bond risk by owning financials. And we own one financial, First Republic Bank, that we actually own. But, you know, the rest of that market, we just add exposure.
I don't know that. They're a regional bank, right?
The KRE we prefer over the XLF because I hate B of A and Wells Fargo and those people.
All right. So let me see if I got anything else for you. I think I've given you the business enough. You said here that you're going to wait for – this will be the last tweet I want to read to you, and I would just want your opinion on this. And then I want to ask you about another company. It's so obvious that the Chinese-Saudis Vision Fund all want in, and Elon has been saying no. This is August 7th. So now he's had enough tender shares to sell to them. $420, what a joke. Shareholders say no, wait for $571. What do you think about that? I mean
– exactly what I said. I really don't want to see this great American company fall into the hands of the foreigners. You know, the foreigners.
So do you think do you think he's been saying no to them, or do you think?
Yeah, I know he's been saying no to them. You know, the Saudi Arabians have been wanting in on this for a while, but the issue really.
But you think now? Really you think now he'd be more inclined to let them in just because he made this statement? I don't understand.
He changed his attitude. So I think that his attitude changed with the frustration of dealing with his business over the last 6 months, where finally he was like, you know what, I can't deal with this stress. I'm just going to sell this company and get some, you know, and also own my part, but I'm just going to get myself out of the stock market. And so I'll take this deal. But see, like, you know, so Saudi Arabia is in a war, you know, with Iran, basically. And so it's all about influence. And one of the things that Saudi Arabia, and, you know, I don't spend a lot of time talking about this, especially on Twitter, but one of the things that Saudi Arabia does is they buy influence. And investing in Tesla might not actually have a lot to do with Tesla, although that's part of it. It also might have a lot to do with SpaceX. And that's, I think, something to think about, which is having access to Elon, being Elon's best friend, might get you satellite launches, especially if you want to put up military satellites against your enemy like Iran. So Saudi
Arabia
doesn't buy...
Wouldn't there be a huge conflict of interest there in assisting...
And Saudi Arabia doesn't just buy stocks to make money. They have so much money. You know what I mean? They're buying stocks to have influence in the world, and they know how powerful the technology...
Well, is that okay with you? I mean, as a Tesla investor,
no,
is that okay with you?
With me. It's not okay at all. And that's my point, is that I don't want them selling this company to the Saudi Arabians. I don't want this company being sold to the Chinese. It's an American company. It's a beautiful American company. And it should be, if sold to anybody, it should be sold to an American company.
Okay. So I want to ask you one more question. You said about Overstock. I don't know if you were joking or not, that you thought it was a good short. Is that accurate?
Well, I don't follow it that close. I think Overstock's just a total dog company. I don't even know if it's a legitimate company.
What do you mean?
Well, Overstock, you know, used to be like a Fry's or like a wannabe Amazon kind of thing.
Right.
And they have a website where they sell junk.
They're an e-commerce business, right.
Right, but they've never done well as e-commerce. Like, nobody uses it. And so they've always lost money.
Well, they've done $1.5 billion in revenue over the trailing 12 months, so it's not that nobody uses it.
Well, let me finish why. Because what they did, which was smart, was they said, oh, you can spend your crypto here or whatever, and then they held the crypto that they had that people spent. So they made a certain amount of money by being involved with crypto. And since they made all that money with the crypto that they held, they're like, oh, we should pivot because we're never going to make money selling junk.
Well, no, and I'm talking about revenue, though.
Revenue doesn't mean anything if you're just losing money. I mean, I could
sell. Well, you could say that about Tesla, couldn't you?
No, I'm saying if I'm running an e-commerce site like Etsy or any e-commerce site.
Well, how about Wayfair? Wayfair's a money-losing company that's got a $10 billion valuation. You don't know Wayfair?
I don't think I know that company. What's Wayfair?
Oh, it's another it's another online retailer. It's
no, I don't know them.
Gone from 10 to 122 over the last like 4 years.
Oh, that's good.
But my point is
owned was Ulta Salons.
So the market is valuing Wayfair, which is very similar to Overstock's legacy business in the sense that it is a money-losing e-commerce retailer at about, 1.8 times sales. And Overstock's being valued at about 0.4 times sales. And there's really no material difference aside from the fact that Wayfair does, I think, maybe three times the amount of revenue, but they're both money-losing companies. And so I guess my question would be, why would one get the valuation when the other one shouldn't? Shouldn't they diverge?
Well, because Overstock is basically a scam. That's what I think.
Why is it basically a scam?
Just from what I've heard. I've heard...
What does that mean?
You know, the people involved in this company and the way they do things is shady. I mean, they have a long history of it, I think. But I don't follow it that closely because I just like sort of don't pay attention to that, area. Once I'm not into something, I just...
So you don't follow it closely, but you know it's a scam.
No, and then what makes it even worse is then they pivot and say, oh, we're going to be a crypto business, right? Like, oh, how fortunate. And then now they're raising money on some, like, ridiculous valuation for this fake crypto business. And you really think they have a crypto business?
Yes. I think T-Zero is real. And I think...
I think they're based out here. You should come visit.
Well, do you think that the people that are investing in this product at $1.5 billion valuation are not doing their due diligence?
I think that...
Do you know what the product is?
I think blockchain sounds really good.
Do you know what T-Zero is?
I once again, I haven't spent a lot of time analyzing Overstock. Overstock is down from $60 to like $25 or
$30. It's $30.
It's down heavy in a bull market. I mean,
So that kind of answers my question.
Look at the chart.
When you said it's
a good, directly
when
correlates
you said it's,
to crypto.
When you said it's a good short, though, you really didn't know why, did you? You were just kind of fucking around?
No, because I think that the crypto business is bullshit. And I have friends in crypto, and nobody's talking about anything.
Do you think there's a difference between the cryptocurrencies and blockchain, and that blockchain can be useful when crypto can't?
Yes and no. I think that from my research, the discussion of blockchain technology is mostly a way to placate people, but I can't think of many companies that have implemented it in any real way. I know they're all looking at it, and we hear lots about it, but there's problems with the blockchain too. There's a plus and a minus to it. Centralization has advantages too. So, I think it's going to be some time, if ever, that this stuff will be mass adapted. It's technology. It's high risk technology.
So your assertion that Overstock is going to be a good short is based on the fact that you think that the stock price moves concurrent with the value of Bitcoin and
with
that
crypto. Yeah.
Okay. So do you think that there's no value at all to their e-commerce business that does $1.5 billion in revenue annually?
None at all.
None. Okay. And why? When the market values...
Because why would I shop at Overstock when I could just shop everywhere else at Amazon?
Yeah, I understand that. But my question is, you don't think that there's any value to that customer base, to that revenue stream? You don't think that a brick and mortar shop that's looking to expand like Walmart went out and bought Jet?
Yeah, that's a great analysis because, Walmart went out and bought Jet before Jet had actually done anything. And so they were able to just integrate it from day one. Jet actually hadn't really started.
That's not true. Jet was relatively well established when they were bought.
Yeah, they had the business model, but they were losing money. I mean, they had not really done anything yet. And that's why they sold. I mean, $3 billion in theory, if it was going to be a great, e-commerce company, isn't that much money. So they sold, obviously they made a good amount of money and they got to integrate with Walmart. And now I think that's paying off big for Walmart and the people involved with that company. So, that was a win for Walmart, but I don't think overstock is that business. And otherwise somebody would have bought it. I haven't looked at the financials, but I'm happy to look at them. And I can probably instantly see what the problems are. Because obviously the stock isn't trading per se on what's happening, it's trading based off Bitcoin. So it's not trading based off the business.
Well, advantageous if the business continues to bring in billions of dollars of revenue annually and the stock is trading uncorrelated?
Well, is that their operating income is negative and has never made money.
That's accurate.
So the fact they run an e-commerce site just loses money. That's why they're pivoting into Bitcoin, because that's the only place they ever made money.
Well, no, so first off, they're not really pivoting into Bitcoin. That's not an accuracy.
Or blockchain, blah, blah, blah,
Well, yeah, they're two different things. But what I'm saying is, if the market is valuing its peer, Wayfair, who you should pull up to if you're at the terminal now, at almost 2x sales, and Wayfair is also a money-losing company. But listen, that's all besides the point, okay? We'll come back and we'll argue.
I mean,
over
you could assign some value on $1.5 billion. You could say it's worth like $300 or $400 million. I don't know.
All right. Anyways, listen, Ross.
No, I mean, I'm just saying,
It is, dude, it's always a pleasure to have you here. I just want to say one thing before we call it a day, and that is, I really appreciate you coming on, man. You know that you're stepping into the fucking meat grinder when you call in and when we do a podcast, and you continue to do it. And I got it. Look, there's a lot of people that listen to me that I know disagree with you on everything when it comes to investments and some things. Certainly we have our disagreements, but the one thing that I can never give you shit for is not having the balls to come on and speak your case. And, that's something that I give you respect for, and I hope my listeners do as well. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate it too, and having me, because, I wouldn't do it if it wasn't an intelligent conversation, and it is. And I actually appreciate that, and I do have to admit that, after our last time I did, take some profits in Netflix and Trupanion.
There you go.
For my clients, because, you were grilling me about this 160 PE thing, we were talking, I think, about Netflix, and, I just, kind of was like, all right, Chris is kind of right. I really can't justify this value. And so we took some profits. Now they're going to put ads on it, and now the stock's moving back up.
Right.
But we sold around 350-ish. But, I'm never sad to take a profit, and I sort of convinced myself that, 100 PE might be fair for Netflix, which even sounds ridiculous on a valuation level.
If you go out 5 years, it doesn't sound...
Had run up a lot, and so I decided to take some profit there because of valuations as well. So I do appreciate these discussions, because I think... it makes me a better investor. So I'm not just doing it because I like to talk or this or that. I actually, and I say this all the time, I prefer an intelligent bear case to argue against every position I have, because it just makes me a better investor. Either I find problems or I solidify more that I believe in what I'm doing. And so I do appreciate from your perspective, because these have been great conversations for me as far as learning, and I do think that you're a very smart guy and you run a good podcast, and that's why I'm doing it. And I like helping you too, because I do think there's a place for people to short, and I think that should be a part of the markets. And I very much enjoy the intellectual process of investing and these conversations, and that's why I'm in this business. And so I appreciate your time and having me on as well.
Well, listen, man, what I'll tell you is that I think you make a lot of sense when you say that. And certainly, if there's two adages that I try to live by when it comes to investing, the first is not to make it personal. There's no investment thesis that you could bring to me that would ever stop me from buying you a beer if I bumped into you in South Philadelphia, one. And number two, I think you make a very good point about surrounding yourself with people that are believers in the other side of the thesis and trying to get to know your counterparty better. And, you know, you can say what you want about you, but I think that makes a hell of a lot of sense. And I think it's going to make you a better investor. I think it's going to make me a better investor. And so I give you a lot of credit for that. And hopefully, man, we come back on a couple months. We'll catch up again.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fun story. So we'll see, you know, what we're talking about today, and we'll see how these things play out. And, you know, obviously, I'm an optimist, and I do hope that Elon gets his shit together, and, you know, but we'll see, you know, maybe we get real term sheets and stuff in the next couple of weeks. It'll be really exciting.
That would be incredible. All right, yeah. Ross, thank you so much again for coming on, brother. I appreciate it.
All right, take care, Chris.
All right. That was the one, the only Ross Gerber from Gerber Kawasaki. Give the man some credit for coming on. I definitely do. And again, I just want to say that this episode was brought to you by my Patreons, guys like Chris Hicks, Brendan Egan, Michael Rossides, Jerry Baker, John Sumner. Appreciate the shit out of you guys. And Ross, I appreciate you too, brother, man. It was great having you on. And I hope we get to argue till the cows come home, and maybe you'll take some more profits in the future after some of our discussions. That would be awesome. But for now, I am out of here. I got shit to do. I will catch you guys later this week. I have some interesting guests coming up. Peace.